Russia's invasion of Ukraine has not only elevated the risk of a nuclear conflict, but also led to some rethinking about the role of nuclear weapons in international affairs. Even before the war, weapon development in North Korea and the breakdown of negotiations with Iran already set back progress in arms control. Meanwhile, China is rapidly expanding and modernizing its nuclear arsenal alongside the rest of its military, prompting warnings of a potential arms race in the Pacific. How should we think about the role of nuclear weapons in the Asia-Pacific and the threats that they cause? What are the implications of a potential nuclear competition between the US and China? My name is Zoe Leung, Director of Track 2 Diplomacy at the George H.W. Bush Foundation for US-China Relations, and welcome to the Bush-China Foundation podcast. Today, we'll discuss the increased nuclear risk and the future of US-China nuclear relations with Eric Gomez, Director of Defense Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. His research focuses on the US military budget and force posture, as well as arms control and nuclear stability issues in East Asia. In 2020, he was a member of the Project on Nuclear Issues Nuclear Scholars Initiative Program, where he conducted research on the impacts of U.S. intermediate-range missiles on U.S.-China strategic stability. He also participated in the 2019 Strategic Force Analysis Bootcamp hosted by Georgetown University and Sandia National Laboratories. I first met Eric when he just published America's Nuclear Crossroads, a forward-looking anthology with Caroline Domini, which examines a wide range of pressing issues in nuclear deterrence and arms control, confronting U.S. policymakers at the outset of great power competition. Most recently, he contributed to the report Active Denial, a Roadmap to a More Effective, Stabilizing, and Sustainable U.S. Defense Strategy in East Asia, released by the Quincy Institute just a few weeks ago. I encourage you to check these out. Eric, great to reconnect with you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Zoe. It's great to see you again through the computer, and thank you for having me on. I'm excited.
Likewise. Eric, let's start with some broad questions. The last time nuclear weapons were used in armed conflict was during World War II, and nuclear arsenals have gotten a lot more powerful since then. Help us paint a picture of how destructive today's nuclear weapons are.
Absolutely. So the destructiveness actually ranges significantly. So the first atomic bombs used in 1945, I believe, had yields, explosive yields of around 15 kilotons, which is, you know, 1,000 tons worth of TNT. And modern nuclear weapons are both much larger than this, but they can also be much smaller. And the US and China, since those are the two main countries of focus here, both of them possess strategic nuclear weapons, which are usually stored on the homeland, have long range up to intercontinental range, and are relatively higher yields. So I believe the US arsenal has weapons upwards of 150 kilotons. So you're talking, you know, roughly 10 times the power of the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so does China, and then their warhead yields, I'm not sure exactly off the top of my head, but I think they go up into the megaton range. What's interesting is that the US also has low yield nuclear weapons and variable yield nuclear weapons. So these are weapons that can have multiple explosive settings and can be sort of tailored to what the mission is that they're doing. So China does not. China looked into developing tactical or low-yield nuclear weapons during the Cold War and ultimately decided not to develop them. And you know, to sort of end my comments on an important point, China as a nuclear power has been very strange and unusual. It has never subscribed to the sort of arms racing and battlefield utility of nuclear weapons the way that the Soviet Union / Russia and the United States did. And that's been an important difference that they might be moving away from. But historically, that has been a foundational pillar of Chinese nuclear thinking, that these aren't battlefield weapons that you can use with sort of frontline units. They're strictly in a more limited role. This has been the state of thinking for a long time. And now the big question is it changing?
Let me just pick up on the piece about China. Since its first nuclear test in the 1960s, it has maintained, like you said, a modest strategic force and has a stated no first use policy to achieve a minimal deterrent. But recent developments seem to suggest a change in their strategic posture. In August of last year, China tested a nuclear-capable hypersonic missile and is accelerating the development of a greater number of warheads and the construction of missile silos. You did discuss these efforts in your piece titled Lean and Effective, which is a component of China's nuclear doctrine. How do you see China's recent efforts? Do they represent a change in posture?
That's the million-dollar question. And I think the honest answer is we don't know. So China's nuclear modernization process started a while ago, like in the 2000s. And what they've done, for the most part, is focused on different technologies, specifically technologies that increase survivability and increase penetration capability. By survivability, I mean this is mostly focused on mobile, adding mobility to forces. So adding road mobile ICBMs that aren't tied to a silo. And because of that, they can enhance survivability because you don't know where they're going to be. You can move them around. You can fire from relatively less prepared launch sites, and you can do things that make them harder to destroy on the ground. This also means things like adding ballistic missile submarines, which are similarly very difficult to detect and destroy. The other set of changes to Chinese arsenal in the last 15 or so or 20 years has been improved penetration capability, and this means getting through missile defense. The Chinese are generally very concerned about U.S. developments on the missile defense side. And in order to defeat this, they've invested in certain new to them technologies. Things like adding multiple warheads, for example, to their ICBM forces. Things like adding more maneuverable warheads, like the hypersonic glide vehicle you mentioned. And this was the trend for a long time, until last summer. And the silo field discovery, what was really important about that is it suggested a increase in number that was significant. The Chinese nuclear arsenal has grown steadily over the years, but very slowly. You know, I'm talking like going up from, say, 100-ish warheads in the 90s or early 2000s to like 200-ish warheads couple of years ago, which is still like a doubling, but it's a relatively small doubling. What the silo fields mean is that now the shift might be going from improved technology to enhance survivability and penetration and more towards bigger numbers. And the reason why bigger numbers is concerning is that it would be a pretty significant break from the history of China's program. So this is where the concern comes in at, are they changing, right? And you could see how there are good analytical arguments to be made for both, no, they aren't, right? You could say that, as the relationship with the U.S. has gotten worse, as the U.S. has continued to expand our missile defense and also our low-yield nuclear forces under the Trump administration, that China sees more threats to its forces and that it can't just rely on improvements in survivability and penetration to fix those threats. Therefore, grow the number, but don't change the posture. Or you could see a much more dangerous situation where, yes, they are changing the posture. And the tricky part here is China has always been relatively opaque about its nuclear strategy. I will say that in authoritative, or, you know, what are considered to be more authoritative sources of information, things like defense white papers, doctrine documents, speeches or remarks by senior political leadership, there hasn't been a significant shift in nuclear strategy detected yet. But most of those documents that we have in the open source are from before the discovery of those big silo fields last year. So I don't know. And I don't think there is a clear answer one way or the other. But at a bare minimum, having many more nuclear weapons gives China the technical capacity to switch its doctrine in a way that it didn't have before. And so at the bare minimum, the possibility of a doctrine shift to something more aggressive is more likely now than it was before last summer.
So in your opinion, what would give China the incentive to deviate or shift from a more defensive or only solely for self-defense to now potentially more offensive use of nuclear weapons?
So I think this has a lot to do with how China sees concepts of escalation control and management. And this is, you know, if you are in a conflict, how do you prevent the other side from issuing nuclear threats against you? And/or how do you do nuclear coercion yourself using nuclear threats? So how China uses the nuclear arsenal that could be used for coercion, it could be used for escalation control. Beyond self-defense, Chinese nuclear forces have also been designed to prevent nuclear blackmail of itself. And this comes out of the Korean War experience when the United States was issuing nuclear threats against China, and also some of the early Taiwan Strait crises in the 1950s, where nuclear threats from the United States, and then later, as Soviet relations worsened, the Soviet Union, China needed this sort of to have nuclear weapons to prevent that sort of nuclear blackmail threat to themselves. I think that is still a big motivator of the force. And if you think that the adversary, being the United States, has greater means to do nuclear blackmail against China, then having bigger arsenals to resist that can also be valuable. I think what we'd have to look for is, does China continue to inject certain ambiguity over its no first use posture? Do they increase day-to-day alert status of their nuclear forces? As far as we know, day-to-day, the Chinese nuclear arsenal is kept at a very low state of alert, to the point where warheads are not attached to missiles in peacetime, which is something that the U.S. does do. The U.S. does attach a lot of missiles in peacetime, especially to the land-based force. If China improves that, that could be an indication that their doctrine is changing. And I think to wrap up my comments here on this particular question, I think the concern about China using a nuclear arsenal, a larger nuclear arsenal, to do more aggressive or coercive things stems from a general fear of Chinese conventional power, where its conventional forces have gotten larger and more capable rather quickly. And there is this sense that they could use that to sort of throw their weight around East Asia more. And one way for the U.S. to deal with that, one way the U.S. has dealt with conventional local inferiority in the past, is make more use of nuclear threats. And if China has a larger arsenal, those threats then come off the table, or they're not as effective. So I think this is part of a general concern within the United States that China has the means to become more aggressive and probably has the will to do so as well. Therefore, it is a sign of worse times to come. I think that kind of concern is a big one. And it's not one that I would, you know, completely dismiss out of hand. Again, this, I think, speaks to what I said earlier about there's just a lot we don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty, and it could go a bunch of different ways. Just having the weapons isn't enough to prove any one way or the other. but it definitely gives China a bigger option set than it had.
Speaking of nuclear coercion and blackmail, in a recently published op-ed in Washington Post about China's military expansion, it says, quote, China is building the capability to use nuclear blackmail to deter a U.S. intervention if it invades Taiwan, following Russia's model. You touch on why China do what they do, but do you think it would work in a Taiwan contingency situation?
Yeah, well, I guess that depends on how you define work. I think, so in the way that the Russians have been using nuclear threats in Ukraine hasn't really been against Ukraine directly. It's been more of this idea of if US/Western intervention accelerates beyond the point where it's at now, then nuclear weapons come into play. And I think that's kind of a no-brainer, right? Like if NATO directly intervened in the war, then yeah, you'd have two nuclear armed powers going at it. And the threat of a nuclear use would be greater just because it just automatically become greater. And so what the US and NATO have been trying to do is like test to see how far that goes. So it's like, all right, well, we won't intervene directly, but we'll continue to sell more and more systems. And the Russians, they aren't fine with that, but they're not going to escalate to nuclear use over it. And so I think in a Taiwan scenario, any scenario where the US directly intervenes in that conflict, it becomes a conflict in the nuclear shadow instantly, because the US has nukes and China has nukes. It would be very dangerous. I think what instead, you know, to draw that parallel, China might make similar threats. And in their mind, that could be consistent with no first use, right? Like, we will not use these nuclear weapons against Taiwan or against the United States so long as the US doesn't attack or doesn't get involved in the conflict on Taiwan's behalf. I think that could be a way that China could use its nuclear arsenal to try and deter the United States from becoming involved in the conflict. Whether or not it would succeed, that's another question entirely. And I don't know, I'm not going to speculate on how the US would react, but any kind of conflict in the Taiwan Strait that has a potential of US intervention is a nuclear one, you know, by just having nuclear powers being involved on both sides. And that was true before China's arsenal, before those silos were in the ground. It's just that the silos might give some sense of credibility or additional heft behind those Chinese warnings of a potential US intervention that it didn't previously have. So yeah, it's entirely possible. But I also think that any kind of aggressive move to resolve the Taiwan question by force on China's behalf, I think there is recognition within Beijing, both in the party leadership and then the military leadership, of all the sort of attendant risks that come with that, no matter what you do, right? Like, it's going to be a big event. There's going to be a lot of uncertainty. And so I don't think that the precise nuclear balance is the only factor at play in determining that risk reward calculus of do we use force or not. It might adjust certain things about how force would be used, the way that threats would be made, stuff like that. But I don't think it's going to be the deciding variable between the two.
This is a great segue for us to dig deeper into the topic of US-China strategic stability. What is the role of nuclear weapons in the US-China strategic relationship?
I think it's important to start off by defining what we mean by strategic stability, because I feel like it's a term that I have a good sense of what it means, but a lot of people differ. So when I talk about strategic stability, when I think of that term, I think things that make nuclear use unlikely. I don't necessarily mean general deterrence, or like the absence of instability. It is a very specific type of stability, and that is if you have a peacetime relationship that no one feels the need to, you know, do a nuclear surprise attack, which was often the way that strategic stability was discussed and debated during the Cold War, when you had the US and Soviet Union with huge, huge arsenals and the reciprocal fear of surprise attack. I think in the US-China context, strategic stability means, you know, what are the incentives for either side to use nuclear weapons first in a conflict, either intentionally or inadvertently? And by inadvertent, I mean, this is like when you're fighting a conventional conflict and countries are doing things for conventional reasons that interfere with the target's nuclear forces. If the US and China were fighting over Taiwan, and the United States is using conventional forces to destroy a missile unit, a Chinese missile unit in the field, because we think it's armed with a anti-ship missile, but it actually is a nuclear armed missile and we got it wrong, then what is the perception on the Chinese side? Do they think, oh, the United States is now searching for our nuclear forces and could eliminate them? Should we take a step to increase the risk of that in an effort to deter? And you get into all these things like differing perceptions and imperfect information and all this sort of nasty uncertainty that could lead to a very bad place. When I think about strategic stability in the US-China relationship, I think intentional nuclear escalation is very rare. So I think there's a lot of general strategic stability. Even if China builds up its arsenal, I think that the US secure second strike is preserved, China's secure second strike is strengthened, and this idea of we're going to try and do big first nuclear use against one another to try and win a strategic nuclear exchange quickly is a very low probability. What I'm more concerned about, though, is the inadvertent escalation stability, is that pathway to nuclear use. Because I don't think that the US and China understand one another very well when it comes to where are the red lines and what does crossing them look like. Because to China, I think what they worry about is we don't want the Americans to think that no first use means you can sit back and use conventional weapons to slowly chip away at our nuclear forces without consequence. And I think on the American side, we want to make sure that our nuclear extended deterrence commitments have credibility to them. And so I think there is a lot of, you know, the two sides kind of not talking at the same levels and not understanding one another well. And in that environment, if we were in a conflict with one another, I think that the risk of inadvertent nuclear escalation is rather high, mostly because of how the United States will likely prosecute a conflict and the types of targets we'd be destroying. And by this, I mean, I think we have a high incentive to go after Chinese missile forces to protect conventional US assets in theater. I think we have a high incentive to target Chinese command and control networks and basically the ways that they would coordinate nuclear response options. Again, not because we necessarily want to take their nuclear forces off the table, but because destroying those are also good for conventional things, but that China would not be able to distinguish the two. One paradox about a larger Chinese arsenal is that it may actually make some forms of stability stronger, in the sense that if China has a much bigger nuclear force, then the accidental destruction of one or two missiles becomes less of a dire threat to China's overall picture, right? Like if I have 10 nuclear weapons and you destroy one, you've destroyed 10% of my arsenal. If I have 100 nuclear weapons and you destroy one, you've destroyed only 1%. And so that type of strategic stability might be somewhat strengthened by making it harder for the US to put real damage on China's nuclear forces, unless we were like just going all out to try and disarm them, which I don't think is highly likely or likely to succeed. But it does raise questions of if their posture is changing. One thing that might come along with that is China might need better sensors and communication links to make their arsenal more responsive. This is called launch on warning, right? The idea that if China is getting warning of an incoming attack, they can order their forces to respond before the weapons land, so that way more forces survive. If China is moving to that, and the US government argues that it is, then destroying things like strategic early warning and, you know, command and control and intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance systems becomes much more dangerous, because now if China can't see an incoming attack, then launch on warning has a big problem. And they might assume that, you know, the loss of that ability means that more pain is coming for the nuclear force. Again, this is a lot of, there's a lot of speculation built in here, but the sort of theory of it, I think, is sound. This idea of, you know, if you're a country in a conflict, you want your nuclear forces to survive. You want them to be as reliable and dependable as possible. And if the enemy starts making that less likely, then you might face some very bad choices of, do I escalate? Do I threaten to escalate more aggressively in the hopes that I can stop those attacks and like end the war before it gets too far out of hand? Do I try to push an advantage, or do I try to win instead of back down? It's a lot of questions. We don't have good answers. The good news about, you know, no nuclear weapons use since World War II is we don't have the data, which means it's hard to tell how states would react. But I also am glad that we haven't had more nuclear bombs go off in a conflict. So I hope we can keep it that way. In the active denial report that you mentioned at the start of this podcast, most of my chapter on nuclear issues of a different US defense strategy talks about these inadvertent escalation dynamics and how if the US were to change the way we do conventional operations, it might reduce some of those risks. So check that out if you want the even longer version of this.
Right. This is very interesting. On the topic of inadvertent nuclear escalation and miscalculation, right now, you know, given the stage of the relationship, the trust deficit between China and the US permeates all issues, be it political, economic, or strategic. And the expectation that, you know, they would work together like the way that China hosted the six-party talks years ago that sought to end North Korea's nuclear program seems quite unrealistic in this day and age. But there are significant shared interests in risk reduction and also like on arms control. What are the confidence building measures with China that the US could reasonably pursue?
So this is really tough. And a big reason why it's really tough is the differences in Chinese and American nuclear forces. So in the Cold War, the US was able to get arms control agreements with the Soviets and also with the Russians afterwards. So the idea of two adversary countries agreeing on arms control is not impossible, right? So just because we don't like each other right now doesn't mean that we couldn't get arms control. The issue has more to do with this big lopside in sizes. So the United States, just for fielded nuclear weapons, has something in the ballpark of, I think the Federation of American Scientists estimated it recently at around 1,700 deployed nuclear warheads. China, by the same estimate from the same organization, Federation of American Scientists, puts that number at around 350. So yes, the Chinese arsenal is growing, but you have this huge starting imbalance. And on the Chinese side, I think there is a general skepticism about arms control if it is used to codify a diminished Chinese nuclear state, right? Like if they're going into a negotiation with the United States and the United States says, hey, we want you to cap your arsenal and not build any more weapons, then the Chinese can just say, well, yeah, but yours is much bigger than ours. And we're not going to do that, right? We're not going to limit ourselves when we're already the weaker party. In the US, Russia, and the US Soviet cases, the numbers were they were more similar in terms of they had roughly equal numbers of overall warheads, roughly similar force postures and ways of thinking about deterrence. And so a lot of those conversations were about how do we mutually reduce. That type of conversation can't happen in the US-China relationship unless China builds a whole bunch more weapons. So maybe like that might be a silver lining to this expansion that China's doing. If they feel like they're coming at a negotiation from a more of a position of an equal, they may be more willing to talk about limits, because then it's not just them building down, but maybe mutual limitations. But I doubt, you know, that is a very thin silver lining. And so when it comes to, well, what could you get? This is tough. I think what it might look like is more discussions about where the red lines are, right? To just say like, hey, for them to communicate to us, hey, United States, if you destroy X, Y, and Z on our side, we'll have a big problem. And for the US to also tell the Chinese, hey, if you destroy certain satellite systems or certain missile defense radars that are forward deployed that provide early warning against a North Korean attack against the United States, China, we may have a problem too. And so it's kind of getting to a place where there's some mutual acknowledgement of, hey, don't touch here or else. And that's imperfect because, you know, both sides could lie to each other and try and say, well, just don't destroy anything. And then we won't have a problem. Or, you know, set pretty broad parameters that aren't actually real. So that's one option. Another option, and that something that the US has tried before, is China doesn't really have much experience in doing arms control, right? Because they don't have those many years of experience that the US and Russians have in terms of just working with one another to get arms control done. And that helps build some mutual trust, some procedures and methods that can help in the future. And China doesn't really have that. So one idea that's been floated by other people than me is that, well, what if there was a way to get the Chinese to have representatives come along to say like a mock New START. New START is the treaty between the US and Russia, that the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. And they have a method in there of verifying, you know, visiting others' bases and saying, okay, well, like, this is what we look for to make sure that you're doing what you say you're doing. It could be possible to create, you know, like a mock or a training type thing where Chinese observers could come and see, like, this is how you do this, right? Like, this is how you verify an arms control agreement. To just kind of build up institutional knowledge about how you do it, in the hope that that can lay some trust or just get some familiarity with the processes and procedures. The downside to this, I think, is that in the current political climate, that's going to be a tough sell. And the US kind of tried this in the 90s. There were efforts from, you know, US weapons laboratories and their Chinese counterparts to kind of do some instructions to one another about, this is how, you know, how do we think about certain nuclear or arms control verification processes? And then I think in the late 90s, there was a big backlash from certain members of Congress who said, oh, China's just using this program to steal information from us. And, you know, the labs contended that no, they weren't. Nothing of that nature was being discussed, but it still was enough to kill the program. And we haven't brought it back since. So those are some ideas. But, you know, I think the issue of us being so far apart when it comes to this type of stuff makes it so that it's kind of difficult to tell, okay, what thread do you pull on to begin the process of just getting to greater confidence and getting to greater trust in the first place.
And the State Department has warned of the risk of destabilizing nuclear arms race with China. With both the US and China advancing and increasing their stockpiles of nuclear weapons, the latter applied more to China, of course. So in your opinion, is the US locked in a security dilemma and a potential nuclear arms race with China?
So I don't know. I think that we're not quite in a nuclear arms race in the sense of building significantly more nuclear weapons, because partly because of the New START Treaty, right? The New START Treaty sets certain limits on deployed U.S. strategic nuclear forces. Big question of, does that treaty, it's already been extended, but where, especially after the invasion of Ukraine, where do the U.S. and Russia go on nuclear arms control, given this new strategic and political reality in Europe? If we got rid of if we didn't negotiate a follow-on to New START, then the U.S. would have the legal sort of barriers lifted and could start increasing its arsenal significantly again. We have time, so this is not a decision that needs to be made in the next couple of years. I think it was extended for, I should really know this. It was either 5 or 10 years. I think it was 5, but it's an open question of, is the US going to be able to continue doing neutral arms control with the Russians that kind of set these quantitative limits? And then I think the arms race will have more to do on offensive versus defensive technologies. So it might not necessarily look like, just building up big numbers alone. It might be, China testing out these systems to help with penetration, like the hypersonic glide vehicle you mentioned earlier, and the US developing hypersonic weapon defenses to try and intercept those, or better offensive capabilities to destroy Chinese launchers before they can fire. And that would get into some of those inadvertent escalation risks that I talked about earlier. So yeah, I mean, it's not looking great. It really is a kind of bearish, uncertain and potentially really dangerous US-China strategic stability future we're looking at. I think there are ways for the United States to take actions that make this somewhat less dangerous, but I also don't think that there is much political will in the United States to do that, because the focus is so much on competition. And so often the tragedy of this stuff is when you kind of need those guardrails, when you need those measures the most, is when it's also the hardest to get them because the political situation is so bad. So yeah, I mean, it'll keep people like me busy. but I've always told friends and family, like, if I'm ever, on the news a lot, bad things are happening, because I don't study happy stuff.
Eric, there's so much more to discuss on this topic, but sadly, we don't have much time left for this episode. Maybe we can close this out by talking a little bit about the Biden's nuclear posture review, which is forthcoming. What specific issues should we keep an eye out for when it is released?
So the phenomenon of presidents releasing nuclear posture reviews in general is relatively new. The Obama and Trump administrations were very open about how much they released. But even before that, we didn't usually get full-on reviews. We usually got declassified summaries. So who knows? There's not a guarantee that we get a full one. And I think that Ukraine is prompting rewrites and reconsiderations as we speak. But the things I would look for is, how does Biden talk about the future of arms control? Does he make an effort to bring in the Chinese and the Russians together on some kind of trilateral agreement? The Trump administration tried to do that, but I think that they were sort of willing to hold the New START extension hostage to get it done, which I thought was a terrible idea. Now that New START has been extended, it kind of reduces some of that pressure. So there might be an opening. There might be some more opportunity for seeing what they can get at the trilateral level. I think that this interesting congressional battle between the admin and Congress over capabilities like the B-83 gravity bomb, which is a very high yield U.S. nuclear weapon, basically only being retained in the arsenal at this point because it could destroy underground nuclear facilities. Cough, cough, Iran. The Biden admin wants to retire it. Congress is trying to prevent it. Similar story for the low yield sea launch cruise missile. The Trump administration wanted to bring it back after the Obama admin retired them. Biden is trying to say, no, we don't need it. Congress is saying, well, we think you do. And so there is this sort of tension between the different branches about, you know, what the U.S. nuclear arsenal is going to look like. The other thing to watch for is, how does Biden handle the bow wave? What the bow wave is the U.S. is on this big nuclear modernization plan that the Obama admin started as part of the deal to get New START in the first place. They sort of said, hey, listen, Congress, if you ratify this treaty, then we will commit to a big nuclear modernization effort that'll take a long time and cost a ton of money, specifically north of $1 trillion over the next 30 years. The issue with that is over half of that money, I think somewhere in the ballpark of 600 plus billion of that money, is going to come due in the next 10 years. And so you have, we don't have visual because it's a podcast, but you know, it's sort of like this big hump of nuclear modernization spending is just beginning. And what that's going to do is create a lot of hard questions about how do the services prioritize, right? Do we build up conventional forces? Do we build up nuke? Do we try to do both and just have the defense budget go even higher than it currently is? The Air Force and the Navy have already sort of said that, hey, listen, we can do nuclear modernization or we can do conventional force modernization and like new conventional systems. But unless we get a ton more money, we can't do both. It seems like Congress is willing to pony up the cash, but you know, the defense budget's going to be north of $800 billion this year. How high does it go? And is there a limit to where Congress starts saying, like, we're not going to have a $1 trillion a year defense budget? So that those are some of the things that I'll be looking for in the nuclear posture review. You know, how does Biden see the role of arms control in his broader nuclear strategy, especially in regard to where does China fit in and how does he engage with them? And then also, how does the Biden admin think about the modernization plan? Is it full steam ahead? Does it get adjusted because of resource constraints or resource trade-offs as we might have to put more resources into Europe? So yeah, I think those are some of the big issues to watch for in the NPR.
Thank you so much for helping us break down these very complicated and dynamic issues. We definitely look forward to your future work. What a pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah, my pleasure, Zoe. Thank you for having me on. And again, I've written a lot of things on some of this inadvertent escalation stuff, particularly in the connection between conventional U.S. military strategy and U.S.-China nuclear risk. So if you're interested in learning more about those things, definitely check out America's Nuclear Crossroads book from 2019, my 2021 piece with Pony on INF range missiles, and the new active denial report from the Quincy Institute, especially chapter 5, I believe, which I wrote and is all about the nuclear aspect of this.
Listeners, remember to look for the Bush China Foundation podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and Spotify, where you can follow our conversations. Thank you for listening.